Chapter 21. Journalism. The paper was the Buffalo Express. His interest in it was one-third the purchase price, $25,000, of which he had paid a part. Jervis Langdon, his future father-in-law, having furnished cash and security for the remainder. He was already in possession in August, but he was not regularly in Buffalo that autumn, for he had agreed with Redpath to deliver his Quaker City lecture, and the tour would not end until a short time before his wedding day, February 2, 1870. Our next letter hardly belongs in this collection, as it was doubtless written with at least the possibility of publication in view. But it is too amusing, too characteristic of Mark Twain, to be omitted. It was sent in response to an invitation from the New York Society of California Pioneers to attend a banquet given in New York City, October 13, 1869, and was, of course, read to the assembled diners. To the New York Society of California Pioneers, in New York City. Elmira, October 11, 1869. Gentlemen, circumstances render it out of my power to take advantage of the invitation extended to me through Mr. Simonton, and be present at your dinner at New York. I regret this very much, for there are several among you whom I would have a right to join hands with on the score of old friendship, and I suppose I would have a sublime general right to shake hands with the rest of you on the score of kinship in California ups and downs in search of fortune. If I were to tell some of my experience, you would recognize California blood in me. I fancy the old story would sound familiar, no doubt. I have the usual stock of reminiscences. For instance, I went to Esmeralda early. I purchased largely in the Old West, in Amuka, and other fine claims, and was very wealthy. I fared sumptuously on bread, when flour was $200 a barrel, and had beans for dinner every Sunday, when none but bloated aristocrats could afford such grandeur. But I finished by feeding batteries in a quartz mill at $15 a week, and wishing I was a battery myself, and had somebody to feed me. My claims in Esmeralda are there yet. I suppose I could be persuaded to sell. I went to Humboldt District when it was new. I became largely interested in Little Bonueva and other claims with gorgeous names, and was rich again in prospect. I owned a vast mining property there. I would not have sold out for less than $400, at that time. But I will now. Finally, I walked home 200 miles partly for exercise, and partly because stage fare was expensive. Next, I entered upon an affluent career in Virginia City, and by a judicious investment of labor and the capital of friends, became the owner of about all the worthless wildcat mines there were in that part of the country. Assessments did the business for me there. There were 117 assessments to one dividend, and the proportion of income to outlay was a little against me. My financial barometer went down to 32 Fahrenheit, and the subscriber was frozen out. I took up extensions on the main lead extensions that reached to British America in one direction, and to the Isthmus of Panama in the other, and I verily believe I would have been a rich man if I had ever found those infernal extensions. But I didn't. I ran tunnels till I tapped the Arctic Ocean, and I sunk shafts till I broke through the roof of perdition. But those extensions turned up missing every time. I am willing to sell all that property and throw in the improvements. Perhaps you remember that celebrated Orthoffer? I bought that mine. It was very rich in pure silver. You could take it out in lumps as large as a filbert. But when it was discovered that those lumps were melted half dollars, and hardly melted at that, a painful case of ulting was apparent, and the undersigned adjourned to the poorhouse again. I paid assessments on ale and Norcross until they sold me out, and I had to take in washing for a living, and the next month, that infamous stock went up to $7.00 a foot. I own millions and millions of feet of affluent silver leads in Nevada, in fact the entire undercrust of that country nearly, and if Congress would move that state off my property so that I could get at it, I would be wealthy yet. But no, there she squats, and here I'm one. Failing health persuades me to sell. If you know of anyone desiring a permanent investment, I can furnish one that will have the virtue of being eternal. I have been through the California mill, with all its ips, spurs and angles, variations and sinuosities. I have worked there at all the different trades and professions known to the catalogs. I have been everything, from a newspaper editor down to a cow catcher on the locomotive, and I am encouraged to believe that, if there had been a few more occupations to experiment on, I might have made a dazzling success at last, and found out what mysterious designs Providence had in creating me. But you perceive that, although I am not a pioneer, I have had a sufficiently variegated time of it to enable me to talk pioneer like a native, and feel like a 49er. Therefore, I cordially welcome you to your old remembered homes and your long deserted firesides, and close this screed with the sincere hope that your visit here will be a happy one, and not embittered by the sorrowful surprises that absence and lapse of years are wont to prepare for wanderers, surprises which come in the form of old friends missed from their places, silence where familiar voices should be, the young grown old, change and decay everywhere, home a delusion and a disappointment, strangers at hearthstone, sorrow where gladness was, tears for laughter, the melancholy pomp of death, where the grace of life has been. With all good wishes for the returned prodigals, and regrets that I cannot partake of a small piece of the fatted calf, rare and no gravy, I am yours, cordially, Mark Twain. In the next letter we find him in the midst of a sort of confusion of affairs, which, in one form or another, would follow him throughout the rest of his life. It was the price of his success and popularity, combined with his general gift for being concerned with a number of things, and a natural tendency for getting into hot water, which becomes more evident as the years and letters pass in review. Orion Clemens, in his attempt to save money for the government, had employed methods and agents which the officials at Washington did not understand, and refused to recognize. Instead of winning the credit and commendation he had expected, he now found himself pursued by claims of considerable proportions. The and referred to as the Tennessee Tract, the heritage which John Clemens had provided for his children. Mark Twain had long since lost faith in it, and was not only willing, but eager to renounce his rights. As he is, of course, David R. Locke, of the Toledo Blade, whose popularity at this time both as a lecturer and writer was very great. Clemens had met him here and there on their platform tour, and they had become good friends. Clemens, in fact, had once proposed to Nasby a joint trip to the Pacific coast. The California idea had been given up, but both Mark Twain and Nasby found engagements enough, and sufficient profit east of the Mississippi. Boston was often their headquarters, that winter 69 and 70, and they were much together. Osh Billings, another of Redpath's lecturers, was likewise often to be found in the Lyceum offices. There is a photograph of Mark Twain, Nasby, and Josh Billings together. Clemens also, that winter, met William Dean Howells, then in the early days of his association with the Atlantic Monthly. The two men, so widely different, became firm friends at sight, and it was to Howells in the years to come that Mark Twain would write more letters, and more characteristic letters, than to any other living man. Howells had favorably reviewed The Innocents Abroad, apostrophe and after the first moment of their introduction, had passed Clemens said : when I read that review of yours I felt like a woman who said that she was so glad that her baby had come white. It was not the sort of thing that Howells would have said, but it was the sort of thing that he could understand and appreciate from Mark Twain. In company with Nasby, Clemens, that season, also met Oliver Wendell Holmes. Later he had sent Holmes a copy of his book, and received a pleasantly appreciative reply. "All was like," wrote Holmes, "to hear what one of my fellow countrymen, who is not a Hebrew scholar, or a reader of hieroglyphics, but a good-humored traveler with a pair of sharp, twinkling Yankee in the broader sense, eyes in his head, has to say about the things that learned travelers often make unintelligible, and sentimental ones ridiculous or absurd. I hope your booksellers will sell 100,000 copies of your travels." A wish that was realized in due time, though it is doubtful if Dr. Holmes or anyone else at the moment believed that a book of that nature, and price it was $3.50 a copy, would ever reach such a sale. To Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis, Boston, November 9, 1869. "My dear sister, 3 or 4 letters just received from home. My first impulse was to send Orion a check on my publisher for the money he wants, but a sober second thought suggested that, if he has not defrauded the government out of money, why pay, simply because the government chooses to consider him in its debt? No. Right is right. The idea don't suit me. Let him write the Treasury the state of the case, and tell them he has no money. If they make his sureties pay, then I will make the sureties whole, but I won't pay a cent of an unjust claim. You talk of disgrace. To my mind it would be just as disgraceful to allow oneself to be bullied into paying that which is unjust. Ma thinks it is hard that Orion's share of the land should be swept away just as it is right on the point, as it always has been, of becoming valuable. Let her rest easy on that point. This letter is his ample authority to sell my share of the land immediately, and appropriate the proceeds, giving no account to me, but repaying the amount to Ma first, or in case of her death, to you or your heirs, whenever in the future he shall be able to do it. Now, I want no hesitation in this matter. I renounce my ownership from this date, for this purpose, provided it is sold just as suddenly as he can sell it. In the next place, Mr. Langdon is old, and is trying hard to withdraw from business and seek repose. I will not burden him with a purchase, but I will ask him to take full possession of a whole tract of the land without paying a cent, simply conditioning that he shall mine, and throw the coal into market at his own cost, and pay to you, and all of you what he thinks is a fair portion of the profits accruing. You can do as you please with the rest of the land. Therefore, send me to Elmira information about the coal deposits so framed that he can comprehend the matter and can intelligently instruct an agent how to find it, and go to work. Tomorrow night I appear for the first time before a Boston audience for 000 critics, and on the success of this matter depends my future success in New England. But I am not distressed. Nasby is in the same boat. Tonight decides the fate of his brand new lecture. He has just left my room, been reading his lecture to me, was greatly depressed. I have convinced him that he has little to fear. I get just about 500 more applications to lecture than I can possibly fill, and in the West they say, "Charge all you please, but come." I shan't go West at all. I stop lecturing the 22d of January, sure. But I shall talk every night up to that time. They flood me with high-priced invitations to write for magazines and papers, and publishers besiege me to write books. Can't do any of these things. I am $22,000 in debt, and shall earn the money, and pay it within 2 years, and therefore I am not spending any money except when it is necessary. I had my life insured for $10,000 yesterday. Whatever became of Mr. Moffat's life insurance? Or the benefit of my natural heirs, the same being my mother, for Livy wouldn't claim it, you may be sure of that. This has taken $200 out of my pocket, which I was going to send to Ma. But I will send her some, soon. Tell Orion to keep a stiff upper lip. When the worst comes to the worst, I will come forward. Must talk in Providence, R.I., tonight. Must leave now. I thank Molly and Orion and the rest for your letters, but you see how I am pushed out to have six clerks. Affectionately, Sam. By the end of January, 1870, more than 30,000 copies of The Innocents had been sold, and in a letter to his publisher the author expressed his satisfaction. To Alicia Bliss, in Hartford. Elmira, January 28, 70. Friend Bliss, yes, I am satisfied with the way you are running the book. You are running it in staving, tip-top, first-class style. I never wander into any corner of the country, but I find that an agent has been there before me, and many of that community have read the book. And on an average about 10 people a day come and hunt me up to thank me, and tell me I'm a benefactor. I guess this is a part of the program we didn't expect in the first place. I think you are rushing this book in a manner to be proud of. And you will make the finest success of it that has ever been made with a subscription book, I believe. What with advertising, establishing agencies, and see, you have got an enormous lot of machinery underway, and hard at work in a wonderfully short space of time. It is easy to see, when one travels around, that one must be endowed with a deal of genuine generalship in order to maneuver a publication whose line of battle stretches from end to end of a great continent, and whose foragers and skirmishers invest every hamlet, and besiege every village hidden away in all the vast space between. I'll back you against any publisher in America, Bliss or elsewhere. Yours as ever, Clemens. There is another letter written just at this time which of all letters, must not be omitted here. Only 5 years earlier Mark Twain, poor, and comparatively unknown, had been carrying water, while Jim Gillis and Dick Stoker washed out the pans of dirt in search of the gold pocket which they did not find. Clemens must have received a letter from Gillis referring to some particular occasion, but it has disappeared. The reply, however, always remained one of James Gillis's treasured possessions. To James Gillis, in his cabin on Jackass Hill, Tulum Company, California. Elmira, N. Y.Y. Jan. 26, 70. Dear Jim, I remember that old night just as well. And somewhere among my relics I have your remembrance stored away. It makes my heart ache, yet to call to mind some of those days. Still, it shouldn't, for right in the depths of their poverty, and their pocket-hunting vagabondage lay the germ of my coming good fortune. You remember the one gleam of jollity that shot across our dismal sojourn in the rain and mud of Angel's Camp. I mean that day we sat around the tavern stove and heard that chap tell about the frog and how they filled him with shot. And you remember how we quoted from the yarn and laughed over it out there on the hillside while you and dear old Stoker panned and washed. I jotted the story down in my notebook that day, and would have been glad to get $10 or $15 for it. I was just that blind. But then we were so hard up. I published that story, and it became widely known in America, India, China, England, and the reputation it made for me has paid me thousands and thousands of dollars since. 4 or 5 months ago I bought into the Express. I have ordered it sent to you, as long as you live, and if the bookkeeper sends you any bills, you let me hear of it. I went heavily in debt, never could have dared to do that, Jim, if we hadn't heard the Jumping Frog story that day. And wouldn't I love to take old Stoker by the hand, and wouldn't I love to see him in his great specialty, his wonderful rendition of Inults in the Burning Shame. Where is Dick, and what is he doing? Give him my fervent love and warm old remembrances. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.